dated 26 August 2014 on your dissatisfaction over the conduct of the department towards the committee's scheduled meeting of Tuesday, 26 August 2014. I have noted your concern, Honorable Chairperson, and find it regrettably unacceptable for what happened in this instance. It is very uncharacteristic for this to happen from my department, which in many instances is ably led by the Director General in the attendance of similar meetings. The Director General was unfortunately not available on this day. I am made to understand that she did submit a formal apology. As is good practice, she however delegated the responsibility of briefing the committee to her deputies. Please accept our most sincere apology for this incident, which will surely be corrected and be avoided in the future. We will ensure that it never happens again. I have also since learned that the meeting has been crucial to for 16 September 2014. And please be rest assured that the relevant official will honor the request to brief the committee accordingly. And regards, Dr. Aaron.
Thank you very much,
presentation is as precise as possible. I don't know.
the presentation that then I hand it over to you.
Thank you, Honorable Members, good morning. I'm here with my team, the DDG. The discussion will be led by Ms. Janelle Hunter, she's responsible for Canada Muslim Digital. She'll also be supported by Ms. Rowan. And Honorable Members, it also, I don't know whether that request was specifically for that day or whether you needed that. There was also a request about an update regarding provinces that have been put under administration. So those reports have been sent through, and I just wanted to list them. Limpopo, which has been under Section 100, and we also had for Free State because of the recent development, and Mpumalanga, and Eastern Cape. The reports would have been presented given time by Ms. Reni, who has been our administrator in Limpopo, Dr. Kacha, who has been fighting fires in different provinces relative to the hospital, because he has a discussion with the hospitals and Ian with regard to the finances in different provinces, because he leads the PSA for us. And as Chair, as we prepare to present, I just needed to make a statement regarding the state of affairs, particularly in this province. Six of the provinces as of last week, maybe that has changed, but I doubt, did not have permanent CFOs. Only six provinces have, six provinces have active CFOs. Mm. I thought I needed to put this on record because it's a matter of concern for us if you consider the audit reports of those provinces. I thought I needed to put that on record. But I'll hand over to you.
Thank you, Gigi. Thank you, Chief President of Honorable. All members, I don't know how you want us to deal with this matter very much today. Whether they just stick to the matter and request them to come back with the provinces, on the six provinces. What do you want us to do? Because Gigi is my right. Gigi, for me, if there are no CFOs, it says provinces. What's the take of members? Because I don't want us to waste time and we do have some work on this matter.
I think it should be said. I should think we need to give ourselves time with the affected provinces. We shall have to go and look at our schedule and see how we fit them. Into our schedules, making sure we develop healthy problems, so that we give ourselves sufficient time to deal with any health issues. Because I've got a question that I'm going to ask, but in order not to delay the process today, may let us rather focus on the presentation and set aside, shall we say, time to engage the provinces directly. It's not an issue that affects nationally in such a way, but it is the COVID systems that are creating problems. So they need to account as provinces to the COVID. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I think that is the approach that we're going to take because we have to do justice in that exercise. It is really affecting the department, but precisely our people. Because for me, the core mandate of the department is not administration. It's the services out there. If we're failing there, it means that we're failing. So we will communicate to you the date. We're going to call your office and the provinces, but you can start with preparation. It will not be long because, you know, these provinces are getting ready. test each and every day. When you see officials from hospitals for testing, you must know that there is a problem. Okay, thank you very much. Can we then proceed without limitation?
Thank you, so we're going to give an overview of the district health system in South Africa in brief, which includes district hospitals. South Africa has made much progress with regard to the district health system since the South African government, through its adoption of the RDP in 1994, committed itself to the development of the district health system based on the primary health care approach as defined in Alma Ata in 1978. What it says is that the national health system based on this approach is actually more concerned with keeping people healthy than by looking after sick people once they've presented with an illness at the facility. The concepts of caring and wellness are promoted effectively and efficiently by creating small management units of the health system adapted to cater for local needs. These units provide the framework for our district-based health system, and in short, this is why in 1994 we decided as a country to go the district route. Some provinces also even have sub-districts, because you then break the bigger district into smaller units so that you make sure the services provided in the smaller units are really based on the needs of the people on the ground. But just to put the district health system in the context of an entire health system, we've got the slide here that says the public health system, it starts with the communities. If we look at the bottom of the third block, it starts with the communities and their health and wellness, with the emphasis on health and wellness and not on the emphasis on sickness, because it's more important to keep people healthy than to be ready to treat them once they become ill. And for that, we have that conglomeration of health services within a health district. But the important thing is to note that there must be a bridge between the actual physical services and our community-based services, and South Africans decided to go for work-based outreach teams, where we have a group of community health workers under the guidance of trained nurses to be that bridge between what happens in the community and what we provide for in our health facilities. And so we know in our country the district health system is managed by the provincial health department, and I suppose for that reason the committee rightly is also concerned with how the provincial health department functions to keep the district health system functioning properly. Then we have the Ministry of Health that's actually concurrent function with the provincial departments of health, and the Ministry of Health is responsible for developing policies and putting out guidelines. But in this country, and this is why I'm proud to work for the National Department of Health, we realize that our responsibility goes beyond that. That we actually, the policies that we make have to make a difference for the people who come to the services in the district and in the community. And then, of course, what we do is assisted and guided by the World Health Organization's policies and principles. So we've organized this health system in a way that we cooperate with a private health sector, with the traditional health sector, and other health sectors, but also we have to work with other departments like human settlements. We will not win the battle against TB in this country unless people have proper houses to live in, where they have ventilation, where they have clean water, and where they have proper access to energy. Water and sanitation is extremely important to us. We come afterwards to battle diarrhea when the water and sanitation has let a community down. It's too late. We need to see that the water is of good quality. Agriculture for food security, because again, when the health department comes with antibiotics for diseases, it doesn't help when someone has not slept well, has not had a proper meal, and doesn't live in an environment that gives access to clean air. Education. Education is the most important activity in this country, because educated individuals are able to look after themselves in all other aspects. And of course, social development, very important to support people where they are needed. We as a health department need public work very, very much if we are to have quality buildings to provide quality services in, and then of course, Eskom as well. And so the health system is made up of all this. It's not just the health department. It's the ancillary health sectors, traditional health, private health. It's the other departments that must help us for us to be able to function properly, to have the proper output, and to have the outcomes that will keep our communities healthy and well. So in South Africa, we've got the national department, the 9 provincial departments of health, 52 health districts. And we are committed to the primary health care approach that speaks exactly what the previous slide said. It's based on what's wrong in the community, and it's got to be a collaboration with other sectors to keep the communities well. So we just want to talk about integration with district hospitals, because the district hospital functions within the district health system. So it's the district hospital, the configuration of community health centers, the clinics, our mobile clinics, our community health workers, our school health teams, and our also our district clinical teams that help us with clinical quality. So the district hospital has got to be integrated into this configuration of services, and there's two levels of integration. There's the integration of the district hospital at a higher level and the primary health care facilities from community level. And then there's also the integration within the entire system, but then the district hospital becomes that important link to secondary services when people need secondary services from secondary hospitals and sometimes very specialized procedures in our central and academic hospitals. I don't have to go, Chair, I think, through this slide point by point, because it only speaks to what previous slides already said. We've got our national department, provincial department, district health management that looks after district hospitals. It also then, in some provinces, they've broken the district up into sub-districts, and the districts still manage those sub-districts. We have your district specialist team that add value in terms of clinical quality. We have our school health team. We have our health program coordinators, and by health programs, I talk about people who manage TB as a program, HIV as a program, maternal and child health as a program. And then we have support managers, because you need HR units, human resource, and then also financial management. We also need supply chain management. And that's the management band then that looks after quality in clinics, in the community health centers. And then from a clinic, we might have satellite clinics. And I'll speak to the definitions if the committee wants me to afterwards. We've got mobile clinics, we've got the hospitals, and we've got our ward-based outreach teams. So again, just to show that we need these different functions supported clinically by the district clinical specialist team to be able to give our people the kind of services that they need and that they deserve. This slide, Chairperson and Honourable Members, is just to show how we organize our facilities around the district hospital so that there is a network of clinics that can then refer through community health centers to district hospitals. Then the district hospital itself plays a pivotal role in supporting primary health care on the one hand and being a gateway to more specialist care on the other hand. We have different sizes of district hospitals. We have small hospitals, and they have about 50 to 150 beds. We have our medium-sized district hospitals with from 150 to 300 beds, and then we have our larger district hospitals. And in some circumstances, primary health care services are rendered where there is no alternative source of this care within a reasonable distance. So what we are saying, when there's a district hospital and circumstances, no close clinic, that district hospital will also provide the primary health care services that you would otherwise get at the clinic. Then this slide shares the kinds of services we could expect from district hospitals, which means they must do health promotion and preventative care. They do trauma and emergency care, obstetrics and gynecology, pediatrics, general surgery, oral health, eye care, care of the elderly, mental health, occupational health, and rehabilitation. Except for labor and maternity wards, district hospitals do not have discipline-specific wards. Patients are cared for in female, male, and children's wards. And what we mean here is in a district hospital, you don't have a full ward for orthopedics, a full ward for surgery, and a full ward for medical. But we have female wards with all the different disciplines. supported by nurses and other members of the multidisciplinary team, provide comprehensive holistic care. Patients are referred to discipline-specific specialists at a higher level when their condition requires that. Key district hospital indicators that we look at to see how effective and efficient they are is the usable bed utilization, to make sure that the hospital has enough beds for the community it is supposed to serve, but not too many that it renders the hospital inefficient in terms of the kind of budget that it expends. The average length of stay is a very sensitive indicator. We use it just as a gauge because sometimes when an institution's average length of stay is longer than normal, there's good reason for it. It may be that some of the patients are very sick TB patients who need to be stabilized over a longer time and then spend a longer time. But usually when we find outliers with something like average length of stay, we investigate to find out what is the specifics in that hospital for the average length of stay to be longer. We also look at the usual number of beds per 1,000 uninsured population to make sure there's services for the population. And then the expenditure per patient day equivalent is also a good indicator of how efficient the hospital functions. Chair, the next bunch of slides are just putting as examples of the information that the department uses. The DG rightly emphasizes that we need to use evidence, and the health department is the one department that uses evidence for the decisions that we make, or for even how we change decisions that were previously made. When the health circumstances within communities change, you need to change your decisions. So these slides are taken from the health systems trust district health barometer. But the health systems trust gets its data from the department, the department system, which is called the district health information system. And as an independent organization, the health systems trust put this barometer out annually, and I know they do invite parliamentarians to the launch, so I hope honorable members are in a position to take up that invitation when it comes up, but I think also there should be an assurance that the chairperson and the honorable members get that annual copy of the district health barometer, because it actually tells us how the districts are doing in the country. It tracks key indicators in terms of maternal health, child health, key indicators for TB and for HIV prevention as well. So this one speaks to usable beds per 1,000 uninsured population. And so we can see if we just look at the list of the districts, what the differences are. And so we are in the process, I'll talk a bit later about the district health system strategy that was just recently approved by the National Health Council, to find out why these differences exist and how we should address them. So it shows differences between the districts, but if we go to the next slide, where we actually grouped the districts within the same province together, it shows that there are marked differences in the province as well, between the districts, because if we look at this line, the yellow bunch is the Eastern Cape.
What is the meaning of the colors?
The colors show the different provinces, and so we took Eastern Cape is yellow, so all the yellow are all Eastern Cape districts. So if I stick with the yellow, which is Eastern Cape, so it shows inpatient bed utilization rate by district, group by province, that in Chris Hani, it's 59%. And then Joe Swabi, it goes up to 68. And if you look at the Eastern Cape, it's actually more, there's more cohesion than other provinces. If we look at the next one, Free State, Southern Futsinyari's got a 54% use. And this week, like Sandile Davi, goes up to 83%. Now, 83% is just an average. If you have an average use of 83%, you can be assured that there are some nights when there's people who don't have a bed. Because then it means there are some nights where it's full 60%, but there are some nights where it's more than 100%. So it shows to the kind of service needs and maybe service replanning that one must see what are the conditions that prevail around Sandile Davi in terms of how your service platform is configured, that is specific Gavi, an 83% utilization rate, and a district like Tavon Kusinyani only 54%. So what is, like, if you use the previous slide, it shows, although we are organized as 9 provinces, we are still one country. The provinces are just all units. So there needs to be reconfiguration within a country, but it shows that even within a province, we need a lot of reconfiguration to get equity. Because ideally, Dr. Carter will correct me sitting next to me, he's the expert in hospitals. I think they're in 70%? 85% utilization, in the healthy utilization for hospitals. So if we look at how things, Ikurumeni with 87 is going over, and so on. The next one talks to the average length of stay, and again, I just use groupings within the provinces to show the differences. So, then we also do quarterly, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, what we call the district health expenditure review. To look at equity in expenditure, so when we do these reviews, it presents us with a clearer picture of funding, distribution, and use of health resources in the district and the province. It's a diagnostic tool to assess to what extent the budget and use of resources advance the objectives of the people's needs. And so it gives an indication of access, quality, efficiency, equity, and sustainability. Now, I'm particularly pleased that now that the National Health Council has approved our district health strategy, we'll also be doing a costing exercise because, unfortunately, the district health is an expenditure review that shows us how much was expended. But what is important that we look at that expenditure against the budget that was initially given. But we know in South Africa already that often the districts and the provinces run out of budget. So once through this approved strategy, when we do the actual costing, we should be able to tell what the budget should be to provide the services for that year. And whether they are now spending correctly against the budget, or are people spending less in some circumstances because they've got a budget that is too small to start with. And I just wanted to give that explanation before we got to the expenditure. And I think, let me go to the slide again that shows the differences within one province with a color coordination. So we need to determine if we take Joe Garvey as an example in the Eastern Cape, if they spend that 54% because somewhere along the line they ran out of their budget. They weren't allowed to go further because the money was maybe used on something else. But it also shows the difference in spending shows that if they only went as far as 34%, it means there were services that people should have gotten that they did not get to. And if we talk about primary healthcare services that work within the district health system, we need to make sure that there's equity for all the people in South Africa, no matter in what corner they live. And a lot of the problems with how budgets are managed and spent point to management problems. It points to management problems at provincial level and also management problems at district level. And this is why going forward, a big focus of our strategy is to see how we strengthen the management of the district health system in South Africa. Now, the rationale for the district health services, why the government in 1994 decided, you know, other than making the services very specific for the people on the ground, why the district health system is a good tool to go with, it's to overcome fragmentation so that there's a unit called the district health system that manages services for that community holistically. And you don't have provincial vertical programs that's only concerned with TB while women are dying of obstetric problems, or only concerned with obstetric problems while a big portion of the community is also dying of TB. Equity, my point earlier, that no matter where we live in this country, we must have access to the same services according to need. according to need of the people where they live. Access and quality, I've spoken about the comprehensiveness. We must be effective and efficient within the district health system. There must be local accountability. That's why we have the drive to make sure that our district hospitals have hospital boards and the clinics have clinic committees and community health committees. And that the local politicians become very, very much involved in what happens in their clinics and in their hospitals. I don't have many slides yet, Honorable Chair. I'll be done shortly. So I just want to pause and share with you an example of what happened when we started our ideal clinic process, because as a country and part of the Minister's Operation Patisa, we're going to turn our primary health care clinics into ideal clinics. But we started this exercise last year as implementation research, as we were doing while we were learning. So we went and we had a conversation with a grouping of clinics in Tshwane to ask what are those things that help you achieve what you're supposed to achieve, and what are those things that are barriers to achievement within the clinic, so that we can start working on this barrier. And this was Parangkua View Clinic, which is a fairly large clinic in Tshwane. And the clinic manager said to me, what helps me greatly is the involvement of our local counselor in what happens in this clinic. And I said to her, why do you say so? Because I mean, we write textbooks about this, but we don't know if we pay lip service to these things or if it really happens on the ground. And she said to me, you've seen what a large clinic this is, and you've seen how clean my clinic is. Do you realize that we only have one cleaner? I said, I can't believe it. She said, yes, because of involvement of our local counselor, we have volunteers from the community assist us with cleaning the clinic. And I like to pause and make that point, because when you look at the dashboard for the ideal clinic, it's got 10 components, but one of the components is the interaction with the clinic with governance structures. And that has come on here because of the examples we got from the clinic ourselves. Here in Cape Town, I also asked the Western Cape to take me to one of their best performing clinics, and when I got in there, the first thing we got was community health, community members serving soup to the patients. So the influence of governance structures cannot be overemphasized. So areas in the current district health system, Chairperson and Honorable Members, that need further strengthening is the service and service delivery platform reconfiguration. It shows to those graphs being at different lines that I showed you earlier. How do we reorganize so that we get those graphs to be more equal? We need to improve on our health information management and use, and if there's time, the DG could tell you a very exciting story of how we are reforming health information management with immigrants through automating ubiquitously. Our human resources need attention. I've alluded to that where you find weaknesses, it's how strong the management and the professionals that are supposed to deliver services are. Pharmaceuticals, equipment and medical supplies, finances, governance and leadership, community ownership, partnership for health. Because although I can elicit good stories, I can also tell you many negative stories. So although I'm saying these things are working in some areas, it's not working in all areas, and our goal is to get all these areas that are listed here, challenges, to function equally well in all service provision points in South Africa. And that's why I say the National District Health System Strategy was approved by the National Health Council July 2014 to address the above issues. So if we look at the principles of the district health system, we set objectives in terms of the current weaknesses within the district health system to meet the principles of the district health system as it is in the National Health Act currently. So if we talk about equity, we've got an objective going forward that we will have a service delivery platform. And by service delivery platform, we mean those the vehicles that we have, our clinics, our community health centers, our hospitals, but also our ward-based outreach teams, our school health teams, how they are supported by the DCS team. We need to configure them in each district in cooperation with Habitat 3. Because people have to come out of good homes. if we're going to win with the health. In collaboration with Habitat 3 project within the Department of Human Settlements, based on the demographics and epidemiology of the community to be served. Access to services, again, the configuration of the service delivery platform. And then how fast we can turn our facilities into ideal clinics, and that is a whole different presentation, Chairperson and Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members, on what we mean when we talk about an ideal clinic. We need to overcome fragmentation, and we need to do this, we need to establish functional district management offices. We need to improve the integration of services at all levels of the health system and in between private sector and other government departments to address the social determinants of health. Our services need to be comprehensive, so we need to organize the health services in the community and in primary health care facilities optimally to meet the Office of Health Standards compliance standards and to achieve targets set for population health outcomes. Because the Office of Health Standards compliance is now functioning from 1 April, they will be inspecting our facilities, make pronouncements to the degree to which our facilities meet their standards, and it's for that reason that as an internal exercise to start fixing our facilities to make them ready for the office that we started the ideal clinic process. But again, to see to comprehensiveness of services, we must ensure that municipalities meet environmental health norms and standards in executing their environmental health functions. We need to continuously improve quality, and again, it's about organizing it to meet the Office of Health Standards compliance standards and to scale up our clinics to all become our ideal clinics. For effectiveness and efficiency, it's the organization, but also we need well-managed budgets and expenditure at district level. Community participation, I've said enough about that. I cannot overemphasize that really. We will not win without community participation. Local accountability, decentralization, again, the office, the district health offices must be functioning. People who know how to run these offices, and they must manage their budgets and their expenditure well. We need a developmental and an intersectoral approach. And then for sustainability, we would need all of the above. Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, just to add there,
at this point, Honourable Members, because I think what the Minister has also announced, there's a way to support the service. So that we have a work stream of district specialist teams to reduce our mortality, maternal mortality, underfed mortality, infant mortality. So for each district, we must have a work stream involving 7 specialists. And when I say specialists, it means med specialists and medical specialists. For national, it's a primary health care nurse, it's a pediatric nurse, it's an advanced midwife. And for the medical specialists, it's an so that they can support delivery in district hospitals. It's obstetrician and gynecologist, pediatrician, as well as a family physician. Now, for the 52 districts, we've not been able to have a full complement of all of these specialists. For instance, in Northern Cape, as an example, it's been very difficult to attract these specialists to such an area. So, but for nurse specialists, it hasn't been much of a problem. I think it was, for instance, there are very few anesthetists in South Africa. But also to move anesthetists in hospitals is also a challenge and put them in district. So it has to be a kind of balance. I thought I would like to raise this idea.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, DJ and the team, for the presentation. Members, very good presentation. Can engage or discuss. I will not stand.
presentation, HRT and your team. There are two questions for me. Why is this sounds like a good kind of organization? I want to know what then happened to the other hospitals, which are not district health hospitals. I would call them subsidiaries of the district hospitals. I'm asking this because what I'm saying is, my conclusion may be that because of your structure, you may be tempted to then concentrate your efforts in improving conditions on your district hospital to the neglect of the subsidiaries. Even besides human personnel, even with the infrastructure, it's a possibility that that can happen. What then happens with the other hospitals? And secondly, I've noticed that, you know, the nurses do not stay long in the clinic, especially in the rural areas. They just come and go, they come and go. I'm not sure, maybe it may be that your conditions of service are not similar, and district hospitals are too attractive. This will then be to the detriment of the other levels below that. I would like to know if you have looked into all those things, like conditions of service, similar levels of payment and all that stuff, which may be moving people away from the other areas to concentrate them in your district hospitals. And then you'll find out that the other areas are suffering. Even with the doctors and all your personnel, have you looked into that? There is also something that talks to school health teams here. Can you please look into that? I hardly see them. I hardly experience any such activity in the schools where I come from. It's a problem. You have got them on paper, practically, I'll say no. No, it's a thing.
Thank you. I would also like to take this opportunity to welcome the presentation by the Department of Health. My question, or some of my questions, are going to be based on practical experiences of the government. But I like the model that I heard when the presenter was doing the presentation of the involvement of the local government structure in the actual running of the healthcare institution. I like it very much because it does assist in actually enhancing the standard of the service, and also the ownership that not the government structure, but it is the structure that has come to actually assist the community members. But I wanted to know where the burden of the soup that they say, is it a clinic burden or if it is a burden that is from a private organization? My question then that relates to practical experiences is this one. When I was still with Google District Municipality, I had an event with people with disabilities, and one of them just collapsed. I don't know whether it was epileptic fit or what, I don't know. But he took him to the clinic. As we were driving to the clinic, he sort of regained consciousness. All the same, we drove to the clinic. We reached the clinic at the time the clinic was closing. And when I requested the nurses there to attend to this person, they said it after working out. I could not believe what I had, because I come from a background where my mother and my sister are nurses. And I've got a fair knowledge of how patients are treated and the kind of attention given to a patient, irrespective of whether it is after our service or what. I'm aware of the labor issues. But I just want to establish from the department whether there isn't any provision, at least for overtime.
In another case, in my area where I reside, at Newton Clinic, there's a clinic there. I went to the clinic for some business. When I drove away, there is this woman that was lying alongside the road. I stopped the car because I'm a public representative. I asked her, lying alongside the road. She said, they couldn't help me at the clinic. They said, I need to go to Koshabi Hospital. It is not the function of the department to organize a service, an ambulance service, to take the patient to the hospital, and they left at their own peril. These are a kind of issues that actually compromise the image of the Department of Health. And as public representatives, we do want to get answers on this issue. And then lastly, I would like an explanation on the Habitat 3 project. Just to unpack it again. Habitat 3 project. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Let me also take the opportunity to welcome the presentation from the department. Honorable Chair, I've got just three issues that I want to raise to the department. But before I raise them, I think one of them is the opening of the state-of-the-art hospital in the Northern Cape. They recently opened Dr. Yariseto Hospital. To what extent does the department ensure that, that the hospital remains a quality hospital? I mean, the state of our technology on equipment that is there that the government has invested. To what extent, what is the plan of the National Department to ensure that that equipment, a few years down the line, they are still useful and they are still intact at that particular hospital? The second issue I want to raise to the department is your security at the rural clinics. We have done oversight of the state as part of our provincial. We went to one clinic. It's in the rural areas of the Northern Cape in Butito. There was a case that was reported for the only two nurses that are actually working at the clinic. Now, one of the nurses is actually scared to come back to work because she was raped whilst on duty. Because the clinic operates from 7 o'clock in the morning and then until 5 o'clock, Monday to Friday. And the security only operates during the night, 6 in the evening, until 6 a.m. in the morning. So what is the plan of the department in terms of compliance? I hear the presentation was dealing about the issue of an ideal clinic. So from the side of the department, what is it that we are doing to ensure that all these clinics in the rural areas, they comply in terms of the legislation and also looking at the ideal clinic concept, what is it that we are doing? There are also volunteers in the different clinics that are volunteering. Like for example, you get a situation where there are two nurses. And in the presentation, it was also alluded that, like for example, the Northern Cape, I'm going to be very biased, Honorable Chair. That's for the purpose of where I come from and all the challenges that we experience in the province. In the presentation, you alluded also that the Northern Cape historically is one of the provinces where the department is actually failing to attract nurses because of the rural conditions in the province. Now, where there's one nurse or two nurses at the clinic, there are also people that's voluntarily from the community that volunteers. And then we find a situation where those people have been voluntary maybe for more than 10 years. And then some of them, they get their stipends or their salaries from NGOs or NPOs. Now, these NGOs are being paid by departments. The department pays. But we sometimes our biggest challenge has been not following up whether those people have been paid or they have done what they were supposed to do. Because those people at the end of the day, they don't get their salaries for 3 months, 5 months, and then yet the department has actually allocated the money into such NGOs. Then it remains a challenge. And then some of them, they become very demoralized and they embark on protests because they've not received the salary. And then ultimately our government get the blame and make it there once we have actually allocated the money to such a service. I think those are the areas which I wanted the department just to clarify more. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair.
I want to check. How far are we to do the second task? services are in such a manner they are. There is one hospital which has been
invited to come and see here, it was a flop. I'm sure that people are sleeping on the floor. We will be visiting that clinic and give you feedback. Not enough beds. Do we have people who are checking these facilities from the department? Or we just give them money, PGA, and we sit back and say, provinces will do. For the mere fact that we have six provinces that are ailing, it says a lot. Says a lot. I see only Okanagan. The province is at the same level as national. I don't know what to say. In terms of the Ebola plan, in terms of the hierarchy, they are at the same level. What are they supposed to do? Why do you then have the national department if you are at the same level as the provincial government? I know the minister is trying his best and very much passionate about health issues. But when you go to health facilities, something's open to you. That's why I'm saying I'm very much depressed. Because if you see people who are sick, queuing for hours to get medication, that's it, that is not my food. The files get lost. People will wait for hours just waiting for a file. That person is sick. They can't get a file. After having seen by the doctor, they will wait for hours to get the medication. What is actually happening to them? I don't know. You will assist us because we don't know. We just see this poor service. Not in all clinics, I must say. Not in all hospitals, I must say. But we are responsible for all of them. For all of them. You have to assist us because for me, the contract that, the social contract that the government has, is between government and the people that are supposed to be there. Administration is means to make sure that services down there are appropriate. And the attitude, that attitude, very good. When you go to those hospitals, don't talk about we don't have enough budget money, we don't have enough human resources. What is the problem? Because we have our own training colleges, nursing training colleges. Why don't we have enough? People, they go there, they are not taken to train, but you're complaining about shortages of nurses. I can understand those doctors, but not nurses, because we've got our own training colleges. Where is the problem? Because for me, if in this current administration we can deal with the management, because it's not on the management of those facilities. Management, financial management, your medication, staff attitude. I think we will stand a great deal for the people that you are serving. I know I'm asking you things that you may not be in a position to respond because provinces are not here, but you are the accounting officer at your level. We'll ask all these questions from you. Unfortunately. But these are the issues that I'm saying I'm very much depressed. People follow committee from the National Assembly, we are visiting in Kumala. Maybe they will also assist us with some specific proposals concerning the situation. Because there have been protests in both hospitals, the big one, Tema, Ferro Ferreira. Since December, there are people who are still waiting for operations. The equipment is broken. I would have to offer to do operations. I don't know, maybe I'm too hard, but okay, the last one is on the ward-based team. Where are those people? I'm from the North Valley. I never came across a living one day. And it is correct that my counselors are participating in my clinic. But I never came across a living one. What are they doing? Versus the work done by AMA home-based care. We have those
not getting anything. Why should we appoint other people parallel to those people instead of empowering those who have already volunteered to do the work? I don't know, but if those people are there, what are they doing? I am really not sure. The last thing, our clinics were managed by the community. And there was that resolution that was taken that they go back to province or national agency. But the standard is right now. From where I'm coming from, we were managing Mbombela, I think about 7 clinics. The standard of the clinics now is worse than it was before. Why are the problems? If we could be assisted so that we can see where we can assist as a police in the police. Thank you, DJ. I don't know who will be, how we will be responding, but unfortunately we have to raise all these citations with this.
Honorable members and chair, I'll start and I'll refer some of the questions. And unfortunately I'm going to be blunt. I'm going to be blunt, honorable members, because we sit with a very dire situation in Mpumalanga. Mpumalanga since January has had 3 HODs. 3. In fact, the one has only spent 3 months. 3 months. You cannot run health like that. You can't change HODs like you're changing a cross off. You can't. If you want to run health in this country, you have to appoint HODs, you have to appoint CFOs, and you have to have management strategy. Mpumalanga does not have a management team. You don't have an HOD. This one has just started. In fact, this one started when last week, and before that, we actually appointed someone from National to help Mpumalanga with NHI. Now, an official of the department, last month, was made to end. Something illegal. You can't even do that. The second thing is that 2 DDGs. No, 2 DDGs have been suspended. I'm just trying to give you a picture.
Mm-hmm.
You've got an HOD gone. In fact, this is the 4th one since the beginning of the year.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a CFO. You actually don't have a management staff. You don't have an HR person. The pharmaceutical person. You see, there are no messages. The pharmaceutical person was suspended, I don't know how long ago. Not replaced. I can give you a list. The districts do not have structures. I think they are part of what I've established. We call them facility improvement teams. Each one of them leads a team. Dr. Mel Freeman, your team is allocated to Northwest. Morawan, your Free State. Eastern Cape. Now, each of my managers are leading teams to go and help them. They can tell you exactly what is happening in each province. They can give you reports. Mpumalanga is our waste and is a concern to us. When you write letters, nobody receives them on the other side. Because there's no one. Our districts are in bad shape. In fact, to be honest, if you really want to change health in Mpumalanga, we start with the executive committee in the province to take major decisions. You can't run health without the management. It's bad. It's bad. You know, it depresses us. Dr. Carter, I think you need to tell the committee how many hospitals you visit in Mpumalanga. He goes to Witbank, he can give you a report about Witbank, maybe Rob Ferreira. Maybe you can tell them. He can tell you from the back of his hand about every single hospital. He's hardly ever at National, Dr. Carter. Now, and I want to premise this by saying, Dr. Carter has been, we actually got him from West Cape. He was responsible for running Tiger Bank, running Protest Kids, and running Children's Hospital. When we address those 3 hospitals, those are our best in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, you come and help us sort out the rest of the hospitals in the country. He runs, he's at Barras, he's everywhere, every day. But, honorable members, Mpumalanga, I know there are problems in Zimbabwe. They're not even comparable. There's no one in Mpumalanga, no one that we can talk to. It's a big concern for us. It's a big concern. So let me start with Mpumalanga before I even respond to the rest of the question. And I just want to share just a few things with you. You should share, this was just that is just how every single facility looks like.
Mm.
Because where I sit, I can tell you through a press of a button, I can tell you how every facility looks like in the country, in terms of people, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of, I can tell you here and now. Now, you see what the problem is, and this is what I told the portfolio committee and the appropriations committee last week. I said, you see, we have to be firm about how we run health in this country. If we're nice about it and we embrace each other nicely and we're not frank and open, we're not going to change the lives of the people in the country. And I just want to be frank and open. And what is done with the data, for instance, we've got 400, and I can show you data. If you look at the former homeland area, former homeland and self-governing states, you'll see there's a cluster of clinics. But go and see what those clinics are. Mm-hmm. Some are houses that were donated by traditional leaders in those areas that no longer respond to the needs of the population.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've got 492 of those. 492 that must be fixed. And we said, they need to be completely rehabilitated. We said, if we talk infrastructure, that's where the money must go. If we want to improve the life, we stop building any other things and start focusing on those so that our people can access better health care. If we want to improve, and we've got 1,000 facilities that do not have adequate space, meaning you just have a small room for a nurse, a small room, and that's about it. You know? So we said 1,000, we must extend them such that we have adequate space. 492, we must just rebuild. And the majority of those are clinics. The majority of those are clinics. And we've got, so we can show you the status. That's why I said we know exactly what the status is for every facility. So I thought I should preface it by that. The third one, and I just wanted to talk about school health. Honorable members, you are saying you are not seeing school health, you are not seeing, let me tell you why you will not see that. Because you said you are going to prioritize quintile 1 and quintile 2. Meaning we'll just target the poor areas and give them priority. And we know why we're doing this. The data that we have shows that for the first level, grade 1 only, we didn't even go to grade 2 and higher level. For grade 1, 54,000 of our learners have hearing problems, have sight problems, they've got TB, they've got, I can give you data, you can see. And we want to go, because you see, we are actually creating a problem for basic education.
Mm-hmm.
We want matric results. Mm-hmm. For children who are in a class, who can't even see on the board, the teacher is not going to know that.
Mm-hmm.
The teacher is not going to know that that child can't hear. Now we've got that data. So we said what we're going to do, and Dr. Kata put up a slide there. That data that we get from Vulindlela. Vulindlela is a data that shows whose salaries we pay every month. If you look at Vulindlela data, 27,000 vacancies in the public sector, in health. 27,000. And I can show you of those vacancies, it's nurses, it's doctors, but the ones that worry me most are your audiologists who have heard those children here. Are your optometrists who must assist make sure, you know, we need to know whether those children need glasses or not.
Mm-hmm.
And we can show you the data. You see that data, we know exactly in every single province how many people do we need.
Mm-hmm.
And what the vacancy. So our concern, and I want to put it up front to members, is that before we build more facilities, at least let's fix the 492 that we have so that we increase access. Because you see, for every facility you build, you must have equipment and you must have staff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it means you keep on increasing staff facilities, but you can't even fix the existing ones. At least let's make those that we have work. Let's staff them, let's equip them, and let's make them work so that we can have decent access to services. We can show you data about maternal mortality, infant mortality, and match that to resources. Because we are saying, provinces must put resources. The money that Treasury allocates goes straight to provinces. When it arrives, they can allocate it wherever they like. It doesn't matter how much we shout. It doesn't matter whether we go to a province to visit and how many times we visit. It doesn't change anything. And I think we just have to be honest and frank and confront this issue head on if we are to change health in this country. Thank you very much.
Next question is, okay, let me give
thank you, Mr. President. I've got a follow-up question to make regarding the issue of the turnover of top officials in the Department of Health in Mpumalanga. As you say, we've got the fourth DG, or head of department, so to say, HOD, from January 5th to now. There are suspensions. DCG in the department has been and so on and so on. Is this an issue within the administration itself, or are there other factors that are influential to this kind of thing? Because if the head of department is not there, who then affects suspension of the top officials? I'm taking clarity in this regard, and I'm being very genuine about this. Is it administrative issues of full of a tie of a or head of department? What is it? I've never heard of that turnover. Never in who knows about full of a tie. I'm a top official.
I'm so emotional. I'm not lamenting.
you look at KZN's results, KZN has been doing very well, as well as Western Cape. If you look at our results from our data.
It's also
like to go back and encourage most provinces to
consider this option of using correctional services for the adult, because when we, if you want, we can have a bilateral and just share some of the problems mm-hmm. with how don't do a sensitive book, as an example. You know, the way we do don't get home. which is the link, which is a risk, because the laundry from hospitals is, has infections, it can be handled anyhow, but this is welcome and we'd like to take that for us. We really appreciate it.
Yes. Also consider executive managers,
Thank you. I'm question writing. I'm Rita Chapel. Let's go.
Good morning. I'm Pilot Gwebo. I'm the Secretary of the Committee.
My name is Virginia Peterson. I'm the CEO of SASA, and I'm supported by the following team. They will introduce themselves. A little introduction. it says that it has something to the total of like 18,000 staff. We're currently in the process because half the work is done by contractors, CPS, and we would have to go in court if it's government's objective that SASA must do the full mandate from application to payment. So we would have to consider within that number to look at increasing the funded post, just to give an idea of the staffing situation. The majority of the staff we have, of the 9,000, are what we call the grant administration staff. They are in local offices. They greet the public personally and take their applications for grants and approval. The full structure will be gradually implemented as we take over the payment function for the grants, which is currently outsourced and will be for a little while because of the court case. And I can always talk about that if you require Madam Chair. In terms of our deliverables, and I see my squad, my program driver is running way ahead of me, and I'm sure she's capturing herself. Ms. Bolohopa?
Yeah.
Is that how you got your client's position? Is that your next stage? Let me speak to what I have in front of me whilst you find it's the table grid with the legends now of the 3 years of the project. I arrived in May 2011 at SASA MAT, and we decided to give attention to key projects within SASA at that time. At that time, and to explain the legend, you will see the color green means we completed the task. The color red means the project wasn't started. The color yellow means that it's in progress. So during the first year of operation, the payment tender was awarded. We completed the task. Yes, it was challenged, but it was awarded. The payment model, that is the future takeover of the payment by SASA, that was not started during that year. Automation, what does automation mean to us at this point? It means our files and the management of the files are a lot more manual than we wanted to be. For example, we have warehouses with millions of documents. We want to automate that. It's a large project, and we've had a task team, and we're almost ready this year, and we'll tell you more about that. Local office improvement, you had SASA getting offices from Public Works. It was not a standardized approach to the office. So you wouldn't say, oh, no, I know this is a SASA office because it has the cubicle, it has indications when you walk through the door, this is customer care. This is where you go for your first phase application. This is where you go for inquiry. That is what we were trying to create. And we've been quite successful. I'd say we're 80% done with our current local offices. And we want to complete the rest and then start working on our service points. So you'll see it in green during that year. Capacity building of the staff. Level 5 and 7 staff are the anchor staff within SASA. They are the ones that take on the applications, the level 7 will then approve the application, so it is very important to build the capacity. We wanted EPWP during that year, but the process was only completed in the following year, so you will see it was in progress. Standardization, when I arrived at SASA, in one office it took 3 steps to get a grant, in another office it took 6 steps to get a grant. So we decided on a 4-step model that to try and be uniform across the country, that's how we would approach it. SASA had come from a disclaimer audit, and we had gone into an unqualified audit for 2011-2012. You will see in the next year. The biggest project we embarked on in the country was re-registration. That's a data integrity exercise of everyone on the system. So it's not just the people getting the 16 million grants, but also their procurators. If Gogo was lying in bed and someone else, her daughter, her son had to fetch her grant, that person's fingerprints was also taken. So you'll see a number of 20.7 people we interacted with over a period of 9 months to improve our data integrity. And you will see further along in the next year, it led to the cancellation of more than 850,000 grants and led to a savings to the system. You will see in 2012-2013, we migrated to the SASA card, where we for banking inclusion all our customers. There are 10 million people who collect on behalf of the 16 million grant. So it will be Gogo fetching her pension plus the 2 grandchildren's child support grant. And that's how we come to that number. So we let the computer get up, go to the bathroom, they'll leave their system open, and or someone uses their password. And in order to deal with that risk, we will have to go through biometrics, and I'll explain it as we go along. The re-registration back office, that's April 2013-14, what we did there, we first gathered all the data, then we had to capture and sort the data, and that led to the 850,000 cancellations. Some of them were voluntary. In some provinces, people just brought back their card and said the child doesn't exist, which was a fake birth certificate. And we did the cancellation, and but we also had some difficulties where the child support grant is given to a primary caregiver. So if you are working in Joburg, but you're living housing, your children are living housing with Google, then Gogo should technically be getting it. And we found in many instances Gogo wasn't getting it. The mother working in Joburg was getting it. Mm-hmm. Gogo wasn't seeing the money. And so when we would go out on our ICOP, Gogo would come and say, but I actually need a child support grant for this child. And we would go on the system for Gogo if they pay it. Mm-hmm. So we found that through this process, we also try to bring the people together and say, no, where the child is, that's where the money is going to be. So we're doing a lot more work on that, but also public education is important. Then the payment model actually started then within September 2013, when ministers put together a ministerial advisory committee. They've been working for a year. In fact, yesterday we got the report towards the finalized report, which will ultimately create work streams towards the payment model for that thing then to yellow. Local offices continue. I think the most important project in that year was linking grant beneficiaries to cooperatives. Where we had in some poor communities where moms and dads were not working but their children were getting child support grants and we could involve them in a cooperative, we linked them to that project. So they'll be part of either the vegetable cooperatives where we get our social relief of distress, or they'll be part of the uniform cooperatives where Sasa uniforms will be made, but also as part of social relief of distress, we have school uniforms that we also embarked on, and NDA, the National Development Agency, is our partner as well in terms of the capacity building, and the South African Bureau of Standards. We've had lots of training, and it's been quite successful. We always believe that some cooperatives aren't working principally as a cooperative. Someone's always trying to be the boss sometimes, and that undermines what a cooperative is, so we have to spend a little more time. I will give you the numbers for fraud management, and just to say, under ICROP, Mikonzo, it's a program that increases our footprint. This is our minister's brainchild. It was launched last year. There's 1,300 poorest wards in this country, but we also found in areas of housing and Western Cape, on the periphery, the informal areas, that the poverty levels were quite high. So we tended to focus our work on the poorest wards, plus these peripheral areas, and we'll say how many people we've targeted. Reduced, we suspended. After we did re-registration, in our plan, because there's a three-year plan, your APPs and your it's within the three-year turnover for the medium-term expenditure framework, we had put reviews that we would review people. But then also the Minister of Finance made an announcement that there was universalized pensions. That means everybody, including the people one day in this room, can apply for the tax of pension too. But now they're looking at the costing and at what age to introduce it. So we felt that reviews and asking people to come in, it became counterproductive. You know, our people were struggling and we suspended that process because we had to bring it in line with the broader government process. The biometrics was stopped. We had put out the tender, we withdrew the tender again because we keep on sophisticating ourselves. Now we have a database of people who are getting a grant, but our database of staff should be able to test against that database, what's called the software database. So we've just had a meeting just now while we're waiting to just making sure that we've got the line up correctly. Because our database, when you come into our office and you put your finger on that little reader, it should be able to connect that with Home Affairs to say you are future, let's be all happy, let's be clean. No, we have contributed to DSD getting the clean one. And Minister said to me, you know, she said to me, okay, don't be so hard on yourself. Keep pushing. Because if you have a big organization the way we do that, with people in an office, he knows, as the acting CFO, I'll tell him, who did that? Okay, one of the 9,000 people who work for you did that, and we're going to find that person and we're going to make them pay for it, because we do have a financial misconduct. But the point is, we are pushing for green, for clean. But it is a big organization now. I'll go straight into the grant beneficiaries. You will see that this slide gives the committee an understanding of how many people we have, the 51.7 million people, and what percentage of the population is actually on the grant system. You will see that Limpopo has the highest number, 42% of their population is receipt of grants. It gives a level of understanding, not just of volume, like who's got the biggest promise, but where the level of poverty is more defining. And you will see, obviously, the second, the province with the largest number of grants is KZN, because they have the largest. But then you will see Gauteng has 12 million people, but only 18% of their population is on grant because it is the economic hub. So we see that. But we also find in Gauteng that the under-inclusion of children is in those informal areas. So we made a purposeful effort, as you'll see in our APP, to work on that. This trip says 31.6% of our population are on the SOCPEN system receiving grants. For the information of this committee, because you are select committee, honorable chair, I have broken down the grants first by type, to give you an answer, and then by province. So I'm not going to run through it. I just thought the committee might be interested to see what type of grant is available in each of the province by what number. So I put that in more information against the bigger amount of grants that we do give, the 16 billion. So that's also mindful of time, Chair. Alright. So then I'm going to go straight to the fraud management. After all the provinces, they are all there. Go to the fraud management page, which is on page 20, the slide. Just to say, in 2012-2013, 7,734 cases were received. But there's also a database. Fraud is quite complicated in that every year you add, but you don't finalize messages because of the processes in the back office and with the justice, but you keep on reporting on it. And you will see in that year 5,000 cases were finalized. They'll say what is the monetary value. In 2013, 2014, 3,500. And in the first quarter of this financial year, 242 cases were already reported. And you'll see the breakdown. You'll see down at the bottom, 242 officials are currently implicated in various degrees in this fraud. Mainly driven by syndicates that work across provinces. Your form can be from entering, getting a fictitious document to trying to open a bank account under this fictitious document to card cloning. There's a wide range of different things. People will walk around in the taxi rank, get 10 people, take their IDs. In a year's time, that same person could actually qualify for a grant through various issues. They will come to our office and they'll be on the system already. So this is quite intensive, the work we are required to do. Unfortunately, it's always unfortunate if it has your own officials involved and other government officials like Home Affairs, for example. So just to say, 242 officials implicated, 50 officials dismissed, 92 suspended, and 9 have resigned. Some do try and run before we can complete the case, but the criminal investigation will continue to be engaged. Litigation against suspects, you will see in 2012-2013, there was 89 litigation cases to the tune of 10.6 million. Then you will see in 2013-2014, there were 62 cases, slight decrease of minus 27 cases, and it was 7.6%. We constantly want to work on litigation against
SASA. They are lawyers who make it their business to come together, whether it's through the appeal process or the internal review mechanism. They tout. They'll go into a line and tout. I'll say, oh, I've been waiting. Can we deal with this on your behalf? And so then when you do get your money or your back pay, particularly disability grants, those are the sticklers because they have to go. Because grant turnaround is 21 days, but we'll speak more to that. So that is the type of litigation that we usually experience. In terms of our alignment with the National Development Plan, because I think it's important that in our strategy that these base documents and the Green Party's manifesto, this is how we've put it together, the alignment. Social protection sub-outcome, we've made it very clear that our first strategic objective then would be reforming the social welfare sector and its services, improve the provision of early childhood development while backing CSD specifically, because we pay child support grants really involved with children, and we need to see government's full impact on the good start the child gets. So we spend time with DSD on that program. And then our critical one is deepening social assistance and extending the scope of social security. Strengthening community development intervention. We spoke of the local socioeconomic gains that a community can make from this almost $120 billion that is put into the market every year in the hands of poor people. And then establish social protection system to strengthen coordination, integration, planning, monitoring, and evaluation of services. And you'll see in the opposite direction of the same, the alignment of child support grant, expansion of child support grant to orphans and other vulnerable children by 2015-2016, automate grant administration information system by 2016, and the introduction of the new social grant payment system by 2017. We put 2017-2019 because the impact of the court case and the new tender could mean that the takeover won't happen, possibly in 2017. Although the court says ultimately, SASA can decide once it's gone through this tender process whether to award or not. The red is just to bring the focus out, man. That's it, the crystal. Whilst all the others are in our sector, the red one is pointing straight at us. Then just to remind the committee that our vision is obviously to be a leader in the delivery of social security services and the how. And the important word in our mission is the customer-centric social security services. We have to be customer-friendly. We have to listen to the demands of our clients. Because if we don't do that in the human rights culture, we'll always be in trouble. And there's been quite a few issues that have at times been difficult to tackle, and we'll speak to that in terms of the challenges at the end. Our slogan is NJALA. We always want to ensure that the right social grant is made to the right person at the right time and place. In terms of the strategic outcome-oriented goal of SASA, expand access to social assistance and creating a platform for future payment of social security benefits to render social assistance to eligible beneficiaries. Lots of people visit us every day, but they're not eligible. Now, our key priorities for 2014-15, going through the trajectory 2018-19, the primary focus will be on reducing income poverty, because that's the core of what social assistance is. We want to improve our service delivery. We want to improve our internal efficiency. And then, the most important thing is institutionalizing the social grant payment system within SASA. That's when we have to carry our full mandate. Our priorities during the MTEP period, and I'll go through those, Chair, the first one is to provide social assistance to qualifying stroke eligible beneficiaries. Now the current status at the end of that financial year was 15.9 million people were benefiting from grants. The take-up rate of new grants during the previous financial year was 1,314, so it's 1.3 million. In the attrition, those who come up as children turning 18 or people on 10th we are in, is that 1.1 million new beneficiaries should be targeted per annum. So we already see where we are now in August, just to give you an indication, we want you to go from 15.9 million to 16 million. But at the end of August, we already had 16.3 million people on the system. But there will still be the attrition of those who die, those who turn 80, those who have temporary. And so we average our figure. The second key one is to improve the management of social relief of distress by ensuring qualifying beneficiaries are not disadvantaged. We put on average 150,000 per year. Now this is to give priority to children suffering from malnutrition. This is a program we started 2 years ago in a place called Mokopong, where at a clinic a young doctor reported that in a period of, it was in that month, he lost literally 5 kids died because of malnutrition. We responded to that. If you look at the Millennium Goal that we are signatory to, we responded to that, and that's how the malnutrition program started within SRD. And particularly the buying fresh veggies from cooperatives is linked to that program. We assist families where the breadwinner has died or is unemployed. We also assist in situations of disaster, which is this province, which does have money, but this province is constantly under flood or fire. So we have spent quite a large percentage of our money within the Western Cape in the informal area due to the conditions under which our people live. And there's obviously for people who are waiting grants, and these are particularly people waiting disability grants. We also give social relief of distress. I just want to say, as a result of the demand, we found that at the end of June already, 141,000 applications have been taken, and that was only quarter one. As a result of that, we had a meeting with Treasury. We will look at environment, the time we make environment and adjustment to be able to sort that. I think the downside of jobs in the previous financial year, where in the first quarter 100,000 jobs were lost, mean that families are in more dire straits. You could actually see that, and therefore the application rate has increased. This is because of a high crop process and requirements. Another of our strategic objectives is to reduce the inclusion and exclusion errors in social assistance. Despite popular belief, not every child is born as a mum come or a grant. In fact, if we look at our stats, there is a lower than expected application rate in the early years. And this is factual. There's been lots of research from UNICEF and other interested parties that kept on saying that there's about 2 million children that is not on the system. And I kept on saying to the staff, when does it become 2 million minus 100,000 so we can see that we're capturing the children? Research was conducted, Chair, and we found that the areas that particularly were needy were the informal areas in housing and the Western Cape, not just the rural areas as we had thought previously. So obviously we would have targeted programs this year to deal with getting those children into the system because they qualify. Also, some parents felt because their children had left school. We want every child to stay in school for as long as they can. But this is a constitutional right to the child up to the age of 18 years. So even if the child's not in school, we should get the social worker to encourage the child. But that does not mean that the child is not entitled to its parents to get a child support grant. We've even gone to Treasury and said, sometimes we're cutting the child turns 18, we stop the grant, and then the child still has 6 months of school left. And children drop out. And ministers actually pushing as something we need to do with Treasury and see if we can, to try and get it to the 19th birthday, particularly if the children are at school. Because we found that you invested so much money in a child and now you stopped on the 18th birthday and the child still has to continue school. The child could be in grade 11, grade 12. It is a deficit planning model for this country if we don't build skills. And to withdraw the money, because as we've gone out into communities, mums have come up to us and they've said, you help me until the child is 18, now what? The child dropped out, the child is good at school. So we're really pushing. We haven't won the battle yet. The treasury battle, money is very tough to come by. We continue to clean up our system so that we can say that we must be able to afford this investment. In terms of organization and which are beneficiaries of CERT. We have an IPOP and a Mukunda program that goes to all the edges of our country, the deepest rural areas we try and go to. We process grants in an average of 21 days. These are the stuff we do, and more than 259, you'll see we wanted to get to 335 local offices have been approved. 480 IPOP Mukunda interventions are planned for this financial year. It's based on last year where we did about 420 IPOP visits. That's in the poorest wards of the 1,300 in some of the Western States and Gauteng in formal areas. Our turnaround time on average has reduced to about 10 days. That's what we wanted to go to. Where we're at the moment, it's about 92% of the people who apply are getting the grant in 21 days, almost in that area. Certain provinces, it's also about where the technology doesn't work well, so then you have to go into a district office to process instead of doing the complete thing at the office. Pay point development. It is with great sadness that I report after 20 years of democracy that we still have pay points in the open. That means Gogo, in many instances, is having to go and collect their money out in the open. Now, with all the progress we've made, we've got a biometric-enabled smart card, but we still have pay points in the open. So I see to the staff team this year, that is the focus. We need to bring dignity to the delivery of where people collect their money. And in the beginning, I didn't even realize there were so many out of the 9,000. Now I'm starting to speak into provinces. I've got two more provinces to go to. Mpumalanga and Northwest is my last provinces. We are engaging staff. We're going to look at the tribal authority, where they have space or government property. We want to erect at least a structure that can serve as a service point and a pay point. Because we feel we owe it to our people. Because the weather conditions in some of these areas are very bad. They deserve respect that we cannot continue. So this will be quite a focus for us. And I think it's going to also mean that rural investment will happen, because we found that most of these were in rural areas, not necessarily in the city centers where there's a community hall we could hire or a church building we could use, but particularly in the rural areas. But Minister has had an engagement with the traditional leaders, and now we just need to work on an MOU and an SLA for delivery to make sure that the money is spent for what it is needed for, and to see how much money we can make available this year to ensure that this program moves. We've done it over the 3 years I'm here, but really slowly, if you look at these 9,000 areas where people collect their money. So it's going to be quite focused and targeted. Then to automate our business, I said about the big warehouses where sometimes you pull the box of files and the snake pops out. Generally, they are rats. We are trying to deal with this legacy of lots of paper. Six files, lots of paper. What is in a file? When I arrived, the application form was almost 22 pages long. It's 5.5 pages now. We have to sit with the auditor and agree on what the auditor will accept as scanned-in documents and what has to be a face-value document. And we're in that process now to implement the biometric physical access to authenticate the staff and the beneficiary, to develop the in-house system of the management of beneficiaries, because we want to say that at the moment, CPS has space in a local office, and they are the ones who do the biometrics of the client, and they issue the card. We want to move with this tender to say that bulk re-reg that the court said we mustn't do again, because we spent money on it. That's fascinating to take over that first responsibility. So that's what we're working towards right now. So when we refer to the data factory, it's also understanding our payment file. At the moment, that the take top-end data, that's the system for application. We give CPS the data, they make up a payment file, they transfer the money through 9 bank accounts in the provinces, through NetBank. Thereafter, it goes into a Grindrod bank account, who holds the accounts for all our beneficiaries, and people can then go and draw their money at a big retail store, a small merchant grocer, a pay point, or an ATM. So this is what we can do. We want
automat, but we have to decide how far to backscan and how much money that will cost. This has also come largely out of an incident of a fire in KZN, where more than 1 million files were destroyed in the Metro file warehouse. Whether that was, no, they said it wasn't sabotage. Ultimately, it was, I just, carelessness that led to the fire. But these are the things that teach us one about the risk in our business. The objective, to implement its full mandate, I've spoken about the Constitutional Court throughout my presentation, and the Ministerial Advisory Committee, as I said yesterday, they presented an interim report. The Office of Minister will receive the full report. Coming out of their work, we will start looking at a parallel process, tendering, but also preparing SASA to take over the mandate, building capacity within SASA, but we will sit down and take their report and make work streams. So you will have a human capital work stream that will say, at the moment, SASA has level 5 and 7, but if it takes over, it will have to have systems operators because of the ICT system. It will have to have people in the payment environment to manage the payment process. It's almost like the banking part that will have to be introduced. So these are the things we're currently working on towards that responsibility. In terms of our financials for 2013 going through to 2016, you will see the historical footnote of what was the baseline of 6.143 billion in 2011-2012, and then if you look at 2014-2015, you will see the baseline is 6.5 billion rand. Then you'll have a revised baseline and the minus 10, because there was changes in each year for various reasons. Some of it was mandatory. Treasury decreased in our baseline. One year, we also assisted social development with some money of our baseline for social workers, particularly for foster care, because we were paying foster care, and some of the court orders had expired, and there was a court case. So you will see the trajectory. You'll see the increases year on year. Last year, there was 3%. This year, it's 4%. But there will still be environment and an adjustment of 50 million rand, which will go to DSG for shared projects that we have. In terms of the economic classification of our expenditure, implementation of staff, because we're still driven largely by the part in doing applications, you will see 2.5 billion rand is spent on that. Goods and services is 3.9 billion, but the critical driver within that is the 2 billion rand we pay to CPS every year to deliver the payment of the pension, which is a reduction from what it was before. Because before the CPS contract, we paid up to 32 rand per unit cost in certain provinces. We then capped it at 16.50 rand. CPS came in at 16.44 rand on average across the country. We feel with this tender we could perhaps make even more savings again. We say even when SASA takes over, there will be capital expenditure in the beginning, but we should be able to reduce the transactional cost. Then we have transfers and payments of capital assets, and the total spend, of course, being 6.5 billion. In just in terms of it's a graphic representation of the share of budget, showing the goods and services versus the compensation and the very little expenditure on the other two items. If we will go to the actual cost driver slide, the share is a key cost driver. Again, you'll see the long bar at the bottom, which is the compensation of staff, and then the handling fees, the CPS, is 30%. So those two make up 69% of the 6.5 billion there. You will see the other issues that drive our work. We had no consultants, we're not planning, we're looking at obviously having some project management in operating our work streams. We'll see how to manage that. But that gives you an indication of the key cost drivers within SASA. An overview of this budget just speaks to each province's share of the money, the percentage share. So, for example, we will see Northern Cape at 7%. It's a large province with little can spend a whole day traveling from Kimberley to Springbok or Kuruman. And I found that within the provinces, there's also inequalities. For example, in the Northern Cape, I think the John Tallow district needs more of our assistance than the other places, because there's just some provinces that you can see whether the boundaries got drawn or redrawn that we need to invest more. So that would be an area of concentration. So in each province, there's certain parts of the province that we want to focus on more, but still deliver the full service. In terms of our risks and challenges, Chair, the payment tender, whether we do it perfectly, Chair, this is about big money, 10 billion rand. Whoever loses is going to take us to court. So I would say to the staff team, you must know that from the beginning. We will try and cross every T and dot every I in this process. But at the end of the day, those who lose have money to take you to court. Mm-hmm. And there were 7 grounds on which the previous tender was qualified and only challenged. And only 2 grounds were raised in the Constitutional Court that they found were real. For example, they said the BEE component. We as in the people who won the tender was a company. So the BEE had certain conditions that they still had internally. The court said SASA failed on that point of validity because it should have gone into each of that BEE people. It wasn't a consortium and checked them out. Physically checked them out. So we've learned. We continue to learn from our processes because the court was scared that we could be fronting. Do you know what I mean? It's a big company that tendered. And it talked to BEE going to emerge 3 companies into 1. So you learn that these are the steps we'll have to take with this current tender, that we must be careful how we put that and be clear in how we manage the process. The other issue was biometrics. And we're going to say it again, biometrics is going to be a key element in this tender again. Because biometrics makes sure that the right person is getting the grant. It links to Home Affairs. We can run it against other systems, and it's important. The biggest challenge in our work at the moment is the unintended consequence of our new payment system in an open-loop system. That means we've got banking inclusion, but deductions. Deductions, whether it is for micro-lending, Moya Manja, airtime for electricity. This is something that Minister had set up a committee who handed a report. I met with the service provider yesterday to implement. If you would have read last week on Thursday, Minister had in Cape Town a press conference where she said to this company, because in this company, CPS Net One, they have about 44 companies. So one company is called CPS, but another company is called EasyPay, and another company is called SmartLife, and another company sells insurance, and another company sells Imolanja, airtime. So we're testing it for conflict of interest. We're trying to see, and every time we write to the company, they say, CPS is not giving people loans. But people from, yesterday I was calling in from a woman, I want to apply for a SASA loan. I said, nah. SASA does not give loans. But you see, because the card gets used as the collateral, but even banks are saying, if you have an income, they don't say how, and it's about deciding whether a grant is an income, the social assistance, understanding what is that quantum. But even in government, DEI says, look, this is not, we can't make this a nanny state by saying you can't give anybody who's on a pension or grant alone. They were not very happy with me because I thought we could pull out all our pensioners out of that system. And they said, no, you are saying, it's like redlining for people, that if something happens like a death or a child goes to varsity, that government is not part of the family deal to get the child in. We're saying it's about the illegality in terms of unscrupulous, too high interest, too many products. You'll find people coming home with 10 minutes. And these are the issues that we challenge with that here. The declining resources, this is a bigger treasury situation where the economic growth, the GDP has had low growth in the country, it challenges everybody. Fraud and corruption will continue to be a problem. We have to get better systems, more policing. We work with all crime intelligence and the justice class chairperson of this committee and the members. Note and support SASA's strategic program and budget for 2014-2015 leading up to 2018-2019. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I've asked you the recommendation. Why should we support it?
Okay, let me give those who want to make improved patients.
Thank you, Chairperson. My compliments on your comprehensive and informative presentation. I see that strategy plays officially in combating the crime that comes with it. My first question is, what measures have you put in place to protect the elderly from commercial media? And it's predominantly then that was simply as a George in George. I know it's happening in both provinces, but mainly in George Hain, the Western Cape. The preventative measures within social development to combat the dependency and expectancy that's happening with teenage pregnancy. Under research, it's shown that teenagers are getting pregnant to get the child, and we're dealing with it by providing the child's grant. What are we putting as a measure in terms of awareness that this money is not enough to cater for the basic needs of the child in terms of education and all this, and not deal with the prognosis, but the diagnosis part of the problem. And the double dipping that's happening with the SASA grants on the elderly really, but on the adults who are in police custody because they are in conflict with the law and still are accessing money from SASA. So they're getting imposed more, or in branch lane, they're getting fed by the government, and then someone is accessing money. And I heard you said your biometrics are in place, but you said just now there's better detection that needs to be done. What are you doing about it? And finally, your collaboration with Home Affairs, I know for a fact, predominantly in our township, people who get deceased, if you only pick it up after so many collections have been made from SASA, after the person has been buried in 3 months, it's only then that you pick it up. So I want to know, what is your collaboration together with Home Affairs in terms of the disease? Because that, if someone dies, let them come back instantly within a week, so that the person who's been collecting a SASA grant cannot access it and not only detect it after 3 months because you can't retrieve the money back. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I support the recommendation. I support the but however, Chair, I would like to have an understanding where you will find a situation where there is this person who has been receiving the funds, but when the time comes, this person has got to be reviewed. But the next minute after the review by the doctor, the fund is being stopped. When you look at the person's condition, it is said this opaque thing, what do they call it? The opaque cataract. It can't be removed. because on the sides, on the white area, there are things like a source. You know, when a person was doing welding without the protective glasses, this person was working in the mine. It says, after being reviewed for the second time, the fund is taken away because the doctor says this person is not liable to get the fund. But the condition of the patient is deteriorating. The condition of the patient is deteriorating because the second opinion from this doctor, it says this person cannot receive any fund anymore. So what do you do in such an instance?
First time I saw some questions, saying here that the popular grant is the child support grant in all the provinces, and it's followed by the old age grant in all the provinces. But I'm surprised by the number three, which is disability. What kind of disability are you talking about? Visible ones or some of them would not be visible? Because I'm surprised really that it grants number three and it's high number.
Mine is on the page on the one this time. And that's why I'm sure the process of the identification. How are they identified and how are they accepted as a patient? Because they even outside that they are associated with each of the process. I come from Jesus in the district.
Okay. No, thank you very much for the presentation. For my side, this issue, just to emphasize the issue of the loan shark, the big one. Not only the loan shark, you know, some of these have security that to look after their food. So that we don't find our elderly people doing in the open. Those are the few issues that I wanted to raise. But the attitude in some saving points where people make applications, attitude of the staff, not good at all. Not good at all. And people, those children, some of them, they don't have money. They will be shunned around. Different offices don't come today, come the other day, go and see social media. They don't have money to move around. I think the service standard is also very much critical besides the number of days. But the service standard is very much critical. But can I?
Okay. It might not be the direct responsibility of staff situation. But we do find a situation where it's unsightly to see the elderly with problem traveling among you. They are kept in towers or blankets because they are not in jail. Who is responsible for that? Because it's very, very unsightly. And how can it be addressed so that at least they are in jail?
Grant is two periods of allocation, which is used that within most communities is that the client would not differentiate between a permanent and a disability, often says this is Sulimyomusele. Now, which simply means that it could be interpreted in different ways. Ufuslela after 6 months does not necessarily mean you're going to review, but it stopped after 6 months. You are only entitled to 6 months. So it simply means that you must go and reapply. You're not going to review it. So that's where the difference is. We have suspended the review of all permanent grants in the last 2 years. So it's safe to assume that nobody who might be permanently disabled will be expected to come and review. So that is the difference between the 6 months and the 12 months of when you can't review those grants, because they are only awarded for those periods, depending on the condition. And I think it's just the word Fuseleda that it seems to be confusing people at large. But by virtue, Fuseleda means to review. You can only review a permanent grant, not a temporary grant. I think the question of the uptake of the disability grant is rank number three. Now, for the last couple of years, there's been a lot of emphasis that's placed on quality assurance because of the high levels of fraud within disability grants. Most people will try to access the grant for the sake of the fact that they might be unemployed. So there's been a lot of emphasis that has been placed. So you've seen a decline in the uptake of the disability grant, because the grant should have never seen as a substitution to avoid the unemployment gap within the country itself. And of course, we've appointed doctors to do quality assurance in most of the cases. If you take cases in KZN where the levels of fraud is very high, they call it an ambulance. An ambulance that would leave Pietermaritzburg and go to Ulundi with patients to go and access a grant in Ulundi from Pietermaritzburg shows that level of fraud that's happening in there, where they would pay certain doctors for a favorable outcome, which is either 6 months or 12 months. So I think we've been quite pleased with the progress in terms of the disability grants, because it has not seen an increase. In essence, there's been a decline in terms, particularly our focus on this year is to do quality assurance on temporary disability grants for the 6 to 12 months, because people feel that it's easier to access the grant in that way. So our focus is primarily within that area. There's the issue of the wheelchairs and the procurators for disabled people. Now, we have what we call procurators. People aren't able to control their own grants, can appoint a family member or any other person within their families to control. Now, you often
to determine whether the pinpoints are still correctly located in terms of the accessibility to our beneficiary, and as well as look at other issues that are involved before you can put up the structure. Because it's not a question of this open land, you put up the structure, but you have to go through probably traditional leaders or local government to get the permission to occupy, enter into some agreement with them. Because we don't want to put a structure on to find ourselves having to remove the structure after some time. Because the local government or the traditional authorities can just say, you take the structure and leave my land. So we had to do the groundwork first. So we have done that. We have done that. We have signed, we have prepared an MOU that was supposed to be signed by the minister and the other parties. But then the we were advised to put it on hold pending the election, because now we have, after the election, now we have new people who came to play, because the MECs as well from the different provinces were supposed to be signatories to that memorandum of understanding. So we started now with substituting the process. But it's a question of consultation. I know the matter was presented to the former, to the previous MINEC, and it seems that it's in some way now that MINEC was also requested in taking the process forward. So we are waiting to that.
Thank you. Ms. Ogle, could you just speak to our methods, deterrent methods to protect ourselves against the vulnerability of fraud and corruption very quickly, particularly focus on the Western Cape? Remember, you can find keys to it in, you've got 1.5 minutes, I think.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Yes, in terms of the money lending aspect of fraud that was raised by one of the members, we have across the country, we are following a crime intelligence approach to identify the hotspots in terms of when money lenders are most prevalent. We then form a multidisciplinary investigative group, including the National Prosecuting Authority and all disciplines in the police, as we then analyze the information that we have and we embark upon operationalization of that information. We've had good success last year in 2013 in January in terms of more than 16 people that we have arrested and that has been convicted in court. In the Eastern Cape, for instance, now we have a huge crime intelligence project underway focusing on money lending because it is unlawful whether the money lenders are registered or not. In terms of fraud, theft and corruption in general, we have the national strategy that speaks to prevention, detection, investigation and the resolution of fraud, theft and corruption. And again, we form a multi-agency approach. We have good successes in, for instance, in Chapa, where the fraud is also very prevalent in terms of the card cloning, where we had two former GPS officials incarcerated to a collective of 35 years direct imprisonment, and an agent has been sentenced as well. So we're constantly upgrading and changing our approaches to investigation and increasing our partnerships in terms of the justice structure to deal more effectively with it. Internally, in fact, we partner with all business units, and specifically we rely on risk management that we bring to fraud prevention to bring in better risk